Wonderful. So I'm going to just get my slides up here. My name is Sandy Curtin. I am a nurse practitioner. I work at the Arizona Cancer Center in Tucson at the University of Arizona. I am also the author of The Building Blocks of Hope, a great passion of mine, along with my thank you. Many, many colleagues who freely gave of their time and effort and expertise in contributing to develop that tool, both physicians and nurses throughout the world. So I want to acknowledge all of their input and help in that. It is a evolving tool, so we are constantly looking to improve it. So we're going to talk a little bit about that here in a moment. Let me get these. And how you can really become really a partner in your care. So I have slides on my laptop, but not on the screen. There we are. Okay, wonderful. So I also am a member of the executive committee for the MDS Foundation. I've been involved with the MDS Foundation for many years. We started a nursing leadership board, which I'm very proud of, which represents many countries throughout the world. So these are all nurses or nurse practitioners specifically working with the MDS population in many, many countries. And so together with our centers of excellence and our physician colleagues, we've been able to really share information across the world, and also have been able to take a lot of our work and translate it into multiple languages. So we're also very grateful to this group of volunteers. These are all volunteers. So just to recognize those contributions. So you heard a lot from Dr. Parr about the disease itself, you know, what we understand, what we're trying to understand, and really how we're going to move forward. And I know that's complicated. It's complicated to us, those of us who do this every day. It's becoming very molecular. And so we all wish we would have paid better attention in our biology class and physiology class, because this is all really coming down to genetics. But for you today, what we'd like to do in the next little segment is just sort of take you through the building blocks of hope a little bit and help you understand what's there. So there are tabs and segments in the building blocks of hope that go through these specific elements: how, understanding the disease itself, how is it diagnosed? So really going through some of the information that you just heard from Dr. Bahar. What are the treatment options currently available, and what is on the horizon? Now, it has not been updated yet with all of the most recent data from ASH, the American Society of Hematology meeting that you heard him mention that was just held about a month ago in San Francisco. So the good thing about this this tool is that it we print as we go now, and so it's a very versatile tool that it can be updated readily, and so we will be doing that. So look forward to that. I know somebody had a question earlier about how do you know if you have the latest version. We have talked about sending out alerts to people to say that there's an update. And so we'll have to make sure that we go back and look at that again for anybody that's certainly that's attended one of these sessions or has ordered the tool through the mail. You can easily go online and view the digital version. It's a actually beautiful web page like a Kindle where you can turn the page, you can focus, you can find a definition. So it's actually very versatile in that way. You heard a little bit about the consequences of blood transfusions. I love the nail slide. I'm going to steal that. That's a great way to explain it. I think to help people really understand what's happening. And then we heard a little bit about transplant centers. So we'll talk more after lunch just about your specific individual questions. We'll have some time here in a minute to talk a little bit about that, but the whole rest of the afternoon after lunch will just be you talking and sharing and having that conversation. So we'll skip through this. I think one of the things we look at is individualizing treatment. And so Dr. Bahar mentioned the concept of risk-adapted treatment strategies. And what that means to us clinically is that every single one of us is different. And we need to look at the whole person, not just the disease characteristics, but you as an individual. Are you otherwise healthy and fit, or do you have several other issues going on, diabetes, hypertension, are they well controlled or not? We consider age. I personally never use the term elderly anymore. I've been doing this for 30 years, so I did not start when I was 10, so if you just do the math, I just use the term older adult, because then I can say you are older than me. Somebody hopefully is older than me. So I don't like the term elderly anymore. So we use older adult. But age alone should never, ever be the single deciding factor. And we have done a lot of work on ageism. So the idea that, I have patients personally that we started treatment when they were 85 years old, and they're 95. And they are living a good, active, excellent quality of life. So age alone should never decide by itself whether we treat or not. But what we do is we look at the things that we know that tell us that your bone marrow is not working like we'd like. And so when you become transfusion dependent, you're needing regular transfusions, we know that you're not making enough red blood cells by yourself. And so we may need to give you some. They're borrowed, they're temporary. So transfusions only last a little while. Those cells live a certain amount of time and then they're gone. They're borrowed, right? They're not permanent. And we know that transfusion dependence brings that iron overload concern. So that's a trigger for us to try one of these, what we call disease modifying therapies. As Dr. Bahar mentioned, something that gets in there and tries to actually change some of those things that he described that make the disease happen. If the other blood counts start getting bad, your white blood cells, your platelets, that's telling us the bone marrow is not working very well, and we're going to want to try to fix the factory, if you will, get in there and make it work better. If you have increasing blasts, this is something that we use in the IPSS and the IPSR to actually give you a risk category. Blasts are immature blood cells. We should never see them in the peripheral blood. They only occur there under stress situations or if there's something else going on in the bone marrow. So the higher the blast count, the more aggressive that disease is behaving, and you're moving more toward the AML trajectory. Now, somebody said earlier in the group here, I can't remember, I was in the back, so I didn't know who was saying it, but that you had a low blast count in your marrow. That goes along with having lower risk disease. So if you have less than 5% blast, that's considered less aggressive. So when the blast count is rising, we want to do something to actually treat the underlying disease, disease-modifying therapy, not just supportive care. So supportive care being transfusions, antibiotics, that kind of a thing. Or if you just have high-risk disease, we know that that disease is likely to progress more rapidly toward AML, we're going to want to stop it. So these are our treatment triggers, the things where we are going to actually talk about instituting one of these disease-modifying therapies, of which today we have three FDA-approved agents, azacitidine, decitabine, and lenalidomide, and or a clinical trial, which would be the fourth option. We talked about how we individualize this. One of the things I always talk about is lifestyle. You know, that matters. Quality of life, as Dr. Bahar said, always matters. That's important to us. I live in Tucson. We have a lot of winter visitors. We are zones. You know, we're the zonies that come to and view right in the summer because it's way too hot. But in the winter, we have a lot of people that come to us, and they come mostly to play golf or just to be in the warm weather. So I have a couple of patients that tell me, you know, Sandy, you can do whatever you want to me, but I play golf on Wednesdays, and that is not negotiable. So we work around that because that's important, right, to give you, we don't want you spending all your time with us. I always tell my patients, you know, we are wonderful people, I know that, we are wonderful people, but we don't want you to spend all your time with us. The whole idea is to have you have a life and do the things that you enjoy. So we take all of these things into consideration. Now, there was a really important comment or topic that Dr. Bahar mentioned, and this is the whole idea that treatment takes time. So this is what I call my ravine slide, and I think it tells a very important story, because I think today still we hear about people prematurely discontinuing therapy. And given that we only have a few that are FDA approved, we want to make the most of each one that we actually have. So this is where you start. So you have this abnormal bone marrow where you have the MDS in there, and the bone marrow is a little bit crowded, and we're going to want to fix that and get rid of some of these abnormal cells. And so when we do that, we actually make things worse initially. So Dr. Bahar mentioned that you maybe you weren't needing platelet transfusions, but now you might. It doesn't mean that everything has gone wrong. It means that we're actually getting into the bone marrow space and we're cleaning out the bad cells so that we can try to help the marrow work better and make some good cells. So you're in the ravine. So you think to yourself, I was only needing red blood cells every 16 days and now it's only been 10. That's okay in the early phase of treatment. We sort of accept that we're going to make it worse before it gets better. And we have this conversation all the time in our clinic with patients, because they'll say, uh-oh, what happened? And we'll say, remember, we talked about this. Things are likely to get worse before they get better. Then you get to the other side of the ravine, and you notice that the numbers aren't quite what they used to be. So they're not way up here. So the other side of that ravine may mean that you don't need transfusions anymore, you're feeling okay, but your counts might not be normal, and they might not be normal forever. But as long as you're feeling okay, you're not needing transfusions, you're not in the hospital, you're not bleeding, you don't have infections, that's okay. It's okay, they're just numbers. So we need to get away from thinking that all the numbers need to be normal. And that's a challenge even for many clinicians today, because they are using measures that we use in other cancers, certainly in solid tumors, which we can never compare to. But even within liquid tumors, the hematological malignancies, MDS is very different in that we may never see a normal platelet count again. And it's okay as long as you don't have symptoms. Your white blood cell count might always be below normal, but if you're not having infections, that's okay. We're okay with that. So we have to really emphasize that the way we measure response to treatment is very different than any other cancer and any other blood cancer specifically. And we still don't have all of our colleagues across the country, or certainly in the world, that truly understand that. So it's important to know this is sort of that new normal, where your numbers might not be not normal, but if you are feeling okay, that's all right. They don't have to be normal. It's just a number. So we basically then hopefully get to where the marrow is repopulated with more normal cells. Now this is the graph up above is actually a slide Dr. Scaris, who's at the Cleveland Clinic, did an analysis of the original data from the Revlimid trials, demonstrating this very thing, where actually the patients who had Revlimid and had a drop in their platelet count after treatment actually went on to have some of the best response. So in a way, it's a good thing that your numbers drop initially and then reset. And so that's something that we also look at in those patients. So the trick is, how do you get through? This is basically, it takes about 4 months in most patients, maybe six. So what we're saying to you is, okay, you meet the treatment triggers. We want to use a disease-modifying therapy, right? So we're going to try one of these things. And what I say to my patients is, okay, we're going to work together, we're a team, and you're going to stick with me here for 3 to 4 months. Because if all you do is give 2 months of therapy and stop, then what we've done is we've exposed you to toxicity without any potential for benefit, or a minimal potential for benefit. So when you start a disease-modifying therapy, you have to commit to those first 4 months, really 4 to 6 months in some cases, for people with normal chromosomes, it may take 6 months. So we need to remember that and not bail out prematurely, because then we're not doing the right thing for you. So there are many things that help us get through this ravine. Some of those we can do dose modifications or delays. So very important, for instance, in the Revlimid trials, I was actually part Dr. List, who I worked with for many years, Dr. Alan List, about 16 years at the university before he moved to Tampa, and he's now the head of the Moffitt Cancer Center there. We did the original trial in Revlimid, MDS-01. It was the only site in the world. And what we did in that trial is when we saw that people's blood counts dropped a lot, we took a break. And we allowed that break to be as long as 21 days. So if any of you are on Revlimid, one of the strategies that we use to help get people through that ravine is a drug holiday, which my colleagues in Europe think, drug holiday sounds very American. I mean, that doesn't mean you're going on holiday with drugs. It means we're taking a holiday from the drugs. So we've had a lot of chuckles over that. But it can work very well to just take a little break. Now, that's very different if you're talking about azacitidine or decitabine, because they work in different ways. So we can use that. Supportive care, we may, again, need more transfusions initially, and then hopefully if you respond, we won't need any. So initially we might need more. And then certainly setting the expectations. So if we all agree that we're going to commit to this period of time and work together to get to the other side, that's going to help all of us really do our best with whatever therapy we're using. Now, I will put a challenge to Dr. Sekris to say that I had a patient that figured this graph out before he did. But I want to use a couple of examples of patients that I've had. So this is a very young patient, 38 years old, had just had her second child, and was very fatigued and a little depressed, and they just thought she had postpartum depression. And the pink line is the hemoglobin, the golden rod is platelets, and the white count is in blue. So you can see in the early part of the graph here that she had very low platelets when we started her, 32,000, not, normal is 150,000. We can go over some of that later. But you can see that things got worse. Everything kind of dropped. These are transfusions. Each one of these little bumps here is a quick bump up, is a transfusion. But nothing really got better until after cycle 4. So you can see all of a sudden after cycle 4, she's getting azacitidine. All the numbers got better. She happened to be young, had a sibling donor, her sister, and went on to have a bone marrow transplant. Had we said, uh-oh, nothing's happening, nothing's changing, it's all getting worse, not better, something, does that mean that's me buzzing? No? Am I hearing things? We would have stopped prematurely, and we would not have gotten to that outcome where she could actually have a bone marrow transplant. So very important to understand, you got to commit to that initial period of time. Now this is the CHET chart, the famous CHET chart. So this is a gentleman who was on our original trial. He just died, unfortunately, in October of this past year of coronary artery disease, not of MDS. But he had been on Revlimid at that period of time, probably longer than anybody in the world, 12 and a half years of transfusion independence. He was truly a rocket scientist, built rocket engines for NASA, and he created this chart because I'm not smart enough to do that in Excel. But again, you can see a very, very quick drop in blood counts early in the phase of treatment. So the other part of what we have to do when we start your treatment is we need to really keep a close eye on you. So we get labs every single week for about 8 weeks, sometimes 12, to make sure that we're doing the right thing to support you through that ravine. So it doesn't mean that intensity will continue forever. It means just in the beginning, we have to really pay a close attention. But there are two very important points here. Number one, so this is the platelet side here. This is why it's so hard, because he has two different y-axis. So normal platelets are 150,000. He had one normal platelet count in over 12 years. That's okay. He was never hospitalized, never had any bleeding, never had any serious infection or illness. The white count, so his average platelet count was somewhere around 70,000. You could do just fine at that number. It's so that's okay. It's just a number, right? As long as you feel well, you're not symptomatic, we can keep going, and it's okay. This is the white blood cell, so I'll come back over here. I feel like Vanna White. This is the white blood cell count, and again, normal white blood cells is 3.5, so if I put my hand here, and more importantly, neutrophils, which are the most important infection-fighting cells, you want your neutrophil count to be about 1,500, and we can talk about that later. But again, you can see most of the time below normal. But he's not infected and wasn't having issues. That's okay. So we have to rethink what we expect our numbers to be, because I know you all probably ask for your copies of your counts, and you say, oh, these aren't normal. That's okay, as long as you feel okay and you're not needing hospitalization or having illnesses and such. So what can you do then is the most important thing, and I have this conversation all the time with my patients, we do a lot of clinical trials, is that half the battle is to be well, and well enough for a trial, and be here. So one of the most important things you can do for yourself is to stay well. And so along with us trying to do our best to control or treat the MDS, we also want you to do the things that are going to help you be well. And so balanced diet, there's all sorts of different crazy trends out there that people are trying to do. My personal recommendation to patients is balance. You know, if you look historically at people that are 95, mostly they just ate a balanced diet. They didn't have McDonald's, you know. So highly refined foods, junk food, lots of simple sugars. It doesn't mean you can't have any sugar. The whole sugar thing is, you know, so any extreme is probably not good for you, whatever it is. So just a balance, good amount of calories and protein so that you can rebuild normal cells and have energy. Daily activity and exercise. Somebody asked about fatigue. So I just wrote a paper on fatigue, and we're beginning to understand some of the physiology of fatigue. Just like Dr. Bahar mentioned, some of these molecular attributes, there are things that we think might be related to fatigue. Primarily, they're inflammatory, what we call inflammatory cytokines, which are basically just substances circulating in the body. But there are a million different things that people have tried for fatigue. Pills, coffee. Well, so that's coffee might work temporarily, but you pay for it later. But the one thing, the single thing that has consistently been measured to be statistically significantly related to improving fatigue is exercise. So it seems crazy, you're tired, and we're going to tell you, come on, let's go exercise. But it doesn't have to be like going to the gym and doing squats and whatever, or running for 3 miles. It can be little things, walking, a little bit of resistance training. I have my patients use those rubber bands, the flat ones, not the ones that are like a rope. And you can do just one little exercise. Because one of the things that happens when you're not moving is you lose your proximal muscles, right? So the quads, which is what help you get up and down out of a chair, in and out of a car, walk up and down steps. And these are the other extensor muscles, the arms here, which help you get dressed, shave, wash your hair. Very important. That's why they do all that aerobic stuff, is they make these muscles work. And they're a very important muscle group. So if you do one thing, you just sit on a chair, hopefully that's not spinning, and up here, and you take your rubber band and you put it under your foot, right? And you just do one motion like this. Then you're not going to fall, right? Now, if you have like a fractured hip or something, this is probably not a good idea. So make sure there's not an underlying injury. But it's amazing, if you just sit and do this while you're doing whatever it is, watching Downton Abbey, how many of you? Yeah. Okay. I just had a nervous breakdown because I couldn't download it on my iTunes when I was just traveling. And almost had to have an intervention. I don't watch much TV, but I am addicted to Downton Abbey. So little things like that can go a long way to build your stamina so that when you do something, you're not exhausted. So just try to get a little routine that you can integrate into your day-to-day activities. Avoiding infection and bleeding. Now, most of us would think that, you know, you get everything from everybody else. In reality, in cancer in general, and certainly in myeloid disorders, which is MDS, most of the infections come from your own body. And unlike a leukemia patient where we give drugs that interrupt the gut, we don't do that in MDS. So the most common infections that we see in MDS are infections that are common in older adults. So pneumonias and urinary tract infections being the top two. So if you stay well, and you're eating right, and you're exercising, you're gonna be less susceptible to those kinds of infections. It doesn't mean you have to close yourself off or put yellow tape around your house, you know, to keep people away. You just have to have common sense. So don't go hang out at the mall on Saturday with everybody. Don't play in the elevator, you know, up and down. You could go to the movies, but maybe don't go on the day when all the kids are there. You can be around children, but you have to be smart about it. It always breaks my heart when people have the misconception that they can't see their grandchildren, because then what are we doing, really? So that's okay. Just if, you know, if they're really obviously ill, not so many snuggles. And kisses, so common sense. Avoiding bleeding, again, if your platelets are very low, generally, this is, you know, spontaneous bleeding usually happens if they're less than 10,000. Most people are never at that level. At 20,000, you might be at an increased risk, but it, are we doing okay? Oh, okay. So we want to keep that in mind. Enjoy the things, live, don't, you know, that's the whole idea, is to make you well enough and give you the time to actually do the things that matter to you. So we don't want to have you be trapped with us. I always just say, you know, I kind of double as a travel agent, trying to figure out how to get people a transfusion in Singapore or wherever they're going to go, if it's safe to do that. So we don't want to have you feel trapped. We want you to live. We want you to do the things you enjoy. And so ask, and we'll try to help plan. It's important for you to do the things that you want to do. Now, if you're trying to go to Machu Picchu, I can't help you there because I couldn't even get up that mountain. I would have to take the train. But if it's all, you know, if you're up for that, then we'll work on it. Get enough rest. So balancing rest with exercise. Did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you. I know that here in the hospital there are therapists, but what my husband that has MDS is looking for is an MDS wellness group so that he can let out his feelings.
So Arlene, you hit the nail, speaking of nails, you hit the nail on the head. So the trouble with MDS is if you're in a big, even in a big city, and you go to a general support group, you might be the only one there with MDS, isn't that right? So it's hard to really relate in many ways to other people that have breast cancer or lung cancer or whatever it is, because it's very different. So that's what this is about. These forums are about is that you are all sort of your own community, if you will, and it's important to be able to share that information. And we're going to spend the afternoon entirely on that kind of thing, just having a discussion. But I think that's a wonderful recommendation, is that it should be a wellness group. It should be about how do I be as well as I can be and live with this disease and not be just focused on the illness, but me as a person and what can make me have more better days than not. So I think we are challenged in that way in creating those kinds of groups. Now, somebody here has a support group. And so we'll do you want to take a minute?
My name's Susan Pope, and we've been meeting up in San Marcos in my family.
Okay.
And on occasion, we'll have speakers, but a lot of the time, it's been just to gather and commune and talk and share what we're all going through with this disease. My own mom has MDS, so
okay.
That's my experience. She's been living with it for 3 years. And the key word is living.
So, Susie, how often do you guys meet?
We try to meet once a month, so this was actually our substitute meeting.
Okay.
Today
on Saturdays?
Yeah.
Once a month on Saturdays
in San Marcos.
In San Marcos. And Susie's last name?
Susan Pope.
Susan Pope.
Like
the Pope. That's going to be easy to remember. So we might have you, where do you live, Arlene? Where do you live?
In Mesa Claremont area.
Mesa Claremont, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah, there.
All I know is there's a lot of traffic wherever you go in California. But so maybe we can have you guys chat about what might be available near you for that kind of thing. I think that's the only way. And you can also check with Audrey Hassan, who introduced herself earlier, because she keeps track of the support groups that are out there that are geared exactly to what you're asking about. So I think that's very important to be able to have those kinds of conversations.
It would be nice if perhaps, I know it's a very sensitive area, but people that are going through it or have gone through it can kind of interact.
Yeah.
That person,
Right. And that's, I think, what support groups do. And there are support groups throughout the country for just MDS, where they're not lumped into.
Not in California.
No, there. I'm sure there are some. So these two ladies in the back are going to find you during lunch. Okay.
Susan's group is MDS specific. And then you can also go on our website. I make sure that our event calendar is kept up to date. Susan does that. Contacts me, so I put all of her meetings up on our website calendar as well.
So if you didn't hear that, what Audrey is saying is we have an event calendar on the MDS Foundation website that lists all the available support groups that would be specific to MDS. We'll have them talk to you at lunch, Arlene, okay? So this is Arlene. All right, good. And so that gets us to getting, taking advantage of those available resources, asking for help. This, I'm a doer. My grandmother said, you're a doer. I do too many things, but I love them all, so I can't stop. But you have to stop and ask for help, and you need to be specific. So, take advantage of people that are offering and say, I need you to go to the dry cleaners on Tuesday and do this. If you're very specific, then that's something meaningful to you. Otherwise, people are saying, oh, can I help? Can I do this? Can I do that? And then you don't ever really know how to organize that help. So make a list, and when someone calls, say, check, whatever it is. I personally don't do dry cleaning because I don't like to take stuff there, and I don't like to iron. So I'm going to have to just wear knits. And then be an active participant. I think one of the things that we're hoping to do is to take in Book 5, which is in your Building Blocks of Hope, and really operationalizing that so it allows you to track your counts, track your disease, keep track of your progress over time. Now, if you're Chet, you know, who's basically a rocket engineer, he already, they're color-coded and tabbed. You can always tell the engineers because they come very well. Anybody an engineer in the group? Okay, so I'm sure you have a very organized booklet. They know how to do Excel spreadsheets and whatnot, but there's a lot of different tools that you can use, and one of those is this Book 5. And we're actually going to work on making that into an app. So just to show of hands, I'm curious, how many of you own a smartphone, so a Droid or an iPhone? So a good percentage of people. Okay. How many of you are on Facebook? Wow. Impressive. Okay. What about Skype? Right? Because you communicate with your family and your grandkids, right? And how many of you tweet? Exactly. Like, who has time for all this stuff? I'm not a tweeter or a Twitter. I guess that would be bad to be a Twitter, I think. But tweeter. I think you're a tweeter if you tweet, right? So basically what we're trying to do is take book five, which includes the tools for you to actually log and keep track of all of your information about your MBS in a digital format. It will also allow you to link to these resources that are live. If you go onto the website for Building Blocks of Hope, you'll find these links that are live. So in the book itself online, you can click on this, and it will take you to these Healthy Body, Healthy Mind websites, which talk about wellness and diet and exercise and all the things that we just discussed. So you can check that out. The web link is in your, I don't think this is hooked up to the internet here, so I don't think I can do it from here. I mentioned Audrey, so this is her email and the toll-free number that is available to you through the MBS Foundation website for additional resources and information. And she can link you to all sorts of people and things where it comes relative to MBS. I mentioned the MBS plan, and then we're going to stop there. We have a couple minutes before we break for lunch, and then when we come back for lunch, we'll have, you know, really sort of just an open discussion, answer questions. If there are things that you heard this morning that weren't really clear to you, we can go into that in more detail. But any other questions before we take a break for lunch? Anybody? All right, think about it over lunch. Write them down so you don't forget. I encourage you to really chat amongst yourselves at lunch, so you might take an opportunity to share some of the things that Arlene was discussing earlier in terms of fears and thoughts or good outcome stories. So with that, we will take a break for lunch. The bathrooms are all the way down to the left, apparently. You can grab something to eat. I think there's a patio outside, and we will see you back here at, let's see, in an hour, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.